Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour editorial review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service to public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and editorial review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the economic bubble right after this. You know, once in a while, we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider like John Swinton, for instance. Swinton outraged his colleagues by replying that there's no such thing at this date of world's history in America as an independent press, and you know it and I know it. And there's not one of you who dares to write your honest opinions, and if you did, you know beforehand that it would never appear in print. Now, I'm paid weekly for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper that I'm connected with, and others of you are paid for similar things. And any of you who would be so foolish as to write honest opinions would be out on the streets looking for another job. And if I allowed my honest opinions to appear in one issue of my paper, before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone. The business of journalists is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. You know it, and I know it. And what folly is this toasting an independent press? We are the tools and vassals of rich men behind the scenes. We are the jumping jacks. They pull the strings, and we dance. Our talents, our possibilities, and our lives are all the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes. That's John Swinton, about 1881. Well, what's changed? You know, these rich men behind the scenes are the movers and shakers of the Global 2000 program today in this New World Order. Men and families like the Windsors, the Rockefellers, Bushes, Bundys, Carnegies, Vanderbilts. That's why I contend that it's time for us to wise up and start listening more to the God of Abraham and to stop following after all of these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians, and let's prepare to live through and survive this New World Order and Global 2000 insanity. Now, if you'd like to learn more about Global 2000, Bible prophecy, and this New World Order, why don't you call and order my 4-hour compact disc package? It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. And you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send your email request. Remember, georgegordon.org, or you can call direct, 417-273-4967. Well, when we talk about the economic bubble, what all does it entail? Well, we hear talk about a housing bubble, and in 1997 through about 2000, we heard about the stock bubble, the stock market bubble. Bonds are in a bubble. The balance of trade internationally is a bubble. The federal deficit is a bubble. General Motors is about to go bankrupt. The pension funds of America are being dumped by major corporations onto the federal government. That's a bubble. Social Security is a bubble. Medicare is on the verge of insolvency. That's a bubble. Inflation is a part and parcel with this economic bubble. So here we are with housing, stocks, bonds, balance of trade, the federal deficit, General Motors, pension funds, Social Security, Medicare, inflation. All of these bubbles all at the same time threaten the economic solvency of not just the United States but of the entire world. So what's the upshot? What are we going to do about it? Talking to the wife the other day, and she said that she's receiving about one call per week from people, listeners, who would like to come here and work on the ranch, or work in the law school, or to come around in some way and to participate in this program. Well, I got to thinking about that, and I said, well, gee, that's pretty flattering. I'm glad to know that there are listeners out there that have that kind of confidence in me, and they say, well, gee, it probably would be a better, safer place for me to relocate in Ozark County, Missouri, although I'm sure that most of you probably couldn't find Ozark County, Missouri, than it is where you are, wherever you're living today. 52 a year. That's one a week, 52 a year. Let's think this through for a moment. Let's suppose that I said yes to all of you people calling me and said, yes, why don't you come work for me? At the end of 1 year, I would have 52 families to support. Could I support 52 families? Can this law school support 52 more families? Can this farm support 52 more families? And the answer to that is absolutely not. Well, not in any standard of living that you're used to or that you would like to become accustomed to. That wouldn't work. But you know, there was a time back in Noah's time, Noah's flood period, when this very same question came about. It was a question of subsistence and survival. How many people are going to survive this worldwide flood? Well, the first olive out of the jar has to be, does anybody recognize that there's going to be a worldwide flood? Does anybody recognize that there are going to be consequences from the housing bubble, stocks, bonds, balance of trade, the federal deficit, General Motors, pension funds, insolvency, Social Security, Medicare insolvency, and rampant hyperinflation? Are there going to be any consequences to that? And if so, what are those consequences going to be? Well, I call that subsistence and survival. Subsistence and survival. When I was a kid, everybody was a survivor. Everybody was a subsistence farmer. Back during World War II, we planted victory gardens. The nation was at war in the same way that it is today. Only we had a more formal, identifiable enemy. Germany and Japan could be located on the map. And those were races or nations of people that were organized into political and economic blocks and that had created a war for the purposes of conquering the world. We could identify that. And there was a problem with food supplies, and things were rationed during World War II. You couldn't get just everything that you wanted. Now, we've got a war going on today. The president keeps telling us that, this war on terror, but nobody has to give up gasoline. We have plenty of gasoline. In fact, the gasoline today is cheaper, adjusting for inflation in 2005, than it was in 1943, right in the middle of World War II. And I say adjusted for inflation. I don't know what your living standards are and how the price of gasoline is impacting upon you, but I'm just telling you that when we adjust things for inflation, which is a part of subsistence and survival, things are cheaper today than they were then. I can remember in World War II, we used to call my Uncle Carol about once a month. He was in the Air Force. He was stationed in Orlando, Florida. So you'd pick up the telephone and place a call to Uncle Carol. And then you'd hang up, and about 20 minutes later, the telephone operator, she'd call you on the phone. She'd say, well, I have your party on the line. And then you'd start talking to Uncle Carol amidst all of the static. Sometimes the call would be broken up in the middle and you'd have to hang up, and then the operator would have to replace the call and things like that. And that call cost $3.70-some cents. So it was just a little under $4 for 3 minutes, about $1.25 a minute to call somebody. And it was poor sounding quality. Today, the last time that I'd heard, our telephone here is 5 cents a minute. So I can get on the air and talk for 60 minutes for $3. I can spend less 2005 inflated dollars to get that telephone time than I could back in 1943. Now, not everything is that way, and adjusted for inflation, everything, or just about everything, is higher priced today than it was back in the 1940s. And some people are having a problem making ends meet, being able to pay the bills. And Americans as a nation are having a problem making ends meet. That's why we have this debt bubble. Yes, we are suffering from a debt bubble in America. The average Joe Sixpack over here has a $70,000 consumer debt. The average Joe Sixpack family, $70,000 consumer debt. Then in addition to that, you have your mortgage payment. Mortgage. That's the median price of a house in the United States now is $210,000. $210,000. Mind-boggling numbers for old people like me that can remember 1955 when you could have bought the house across the street for $28,000 and it was inflated. I mean, it was an astronomical sum to be asking for a house in 1950 to 55, $28,000 for a house. My grandmother bought a big old Victorian house, 1724 8th Street, Eureka, California, for $4,400 in 1944. $4,400, 1944. $50 a month payment, 6% interest. Now, I bet you that house today would be $200,000 plus, probably plus. Now, what's the upshot of all of this? If you're not able to make ends meet, if there's a threat to your health, safety, and welfare, what are you going to do about it? Well, Jim Puplava, P-U-P-L-A-V-A, writes a financial newsletter, Financial Sense Online. I thought I'd start there and take you through this thing called the core rate of inflation. Now, today, as inflation goes up, people are reveling in the housing bubble, and they say to themselves, wow, my house is worth more money. Well, the truth of the matter is your house is worth more dollars, but it's not worth more purchasing power. In fact, the purchasing power of your house today probably isn't much different than the purchasing power of your house in 1955. Maybe it's a little higher because of the inflation bubble. Maybe it's the same. Maybe it's a little lower. But most people can relate to housing. They've got a house. You own a house. 68% of Americans today own their own home. We use that term home ownership. These people actually don't own their homes. What they have is an equitable interest in the bank's house that they call their home, and they call that home ownership. They've been taught to do that. If you're making payments on something, you're taught that that's your property. Our concepts of property and property values, real and chattel property, is somewhat different today than it was 50 years ago. Now, if you're on Social Security, you are tied to the CPI. That's called the Consumer Price Index. And this Consumer Price Index is what the government tells us is inflation. They tell us, well, the CPI is holding at zero. There was no inflation for May, or the inflation rate was 1 or 2 or 3% a year. Now, prices are going up, and you all know that. The price of gasoline has been going up. Price of oil has been going up. Price of housing is going up. And this is a part parcel with inflation, because see, inflation is the general rise in prices. General rise in prices. Now, there's a lot of arguments about, well, what causes this? Is it government creating and printing more money, or is it greedy capitalists and so on? But the core rate is an important element to this thing that we call the Consumer Price Index. And if you're on Social Security, or if you have a labor contract and your wages are dependent upon the CPI, well, then it's very important. This core rate is very important to you. Now, most people do not know what the CPI is. They don't know what the core rate of the CPI is. Wouldn't know how to find it out or figure it out. But Jim Puplava of Financial Sense Online has a page out. You can probably go to www.financialsense.com/stormwatch2005, and you can get a copy of this report. So I thought I'd start here. Let's take a look at the report on the core rate called The Disconnect. A caller into a Washington, D.C. talk show asked a very pertinent question regarding the business of living. Have they changed the way they measure the rate of inflation? Well, the CPI report in May was 0%, excluding food and energy. Let me pause for a moment and let me underline excluding food and energy. So I suppose that if you don't count gasoline prices or food, that is, if you don't eat and you don't drive, or if you don't buy anything that is related to energy, well, then inflation isn't a problem to you, and the May inflation rate was 0%. But if you take those things out, that is what is primarily driving up everything else, what would be the real inflation rate if you add back everything that they take out? Well, the host of the talk show turned to his guest, a financial reporter from the New York Times. The host of the show and the Times reporter were caught flat-footed. The Times reporter could not answer the question, and the host of the talk show went on to say, quote, the inflation rate, as it is reported, has been quite low over the past few years. Next caller, unquote. Well, let's take a look at this. Puplava says that that's a pretty good question. The caller to the show reflected the growing disconnect between Main Street, Washington, and Wall Street. Every month, consumers see their living costs are going up, whether at the grocery store, the gas station, or at the end of the month when the bills are paid. Personal income has stagnated, failing to keep pace with the rise in the cost of living, and in the meantime, the media keeps spinning any increase, whether it is booming real estate prices, rising gasoline prices, grocery bills, doctor and dentist bills, or movie tickets, as non-events. Prices keep going up. Wages keep falling further behind, and it is a repeat of the stagflation period of the 1970s, taxes and inflation. Now, inflation is on the rise, and so are taxes. You see, property taxes go up each year, making it difficult for homeowners to hang on and make those payments. The Social Security base rises each year, making more of a worker's income subject to the tax. States are raising sales tax and auxiliary fees, while some states have raised income tax rates. Like many of the items of the CPI index, rising taxes never get counted in the cost of living. Well, in effect, what this caller was asking was how and when did they change the way that they measure the rate of inflation? On a first-hand basis, he was experiencing inflation in his personal life with rising food and energy costs. There was a major disconnect between what he experienced in real life on a day-to-day basis and what he was being told in published inflation reports put out by the government and reported in major newspapers and on the major media outlets. The host of the show and the financial reporter from the Times had no answers to this question. Washington, we have a problem. The caller was smart enough to know something changed, and he was right. In the early 1990s, the government realized that it had a problem with rising entitlement costs for Social Security, Medicare, and government pensions. These entitlement payments were indexed by the inflation rate each year. With inflation on the rise, it meant that these costs were rising faster, thus making government deficits much worse. And in order to bring the government deficits under control, it would be necessary to bring rising entitlement costs down. Well, one way to lower these entitlements would be to bring the inflation rate down, which would translate into lower cost of living adjustments, also known as COLA, C-O-L-A, COLAs, cost of living adjustments. And the way to do this was to bring down the rate of inflation. However, this was not done by natural means, but artificially through statistical manipulation. The supply of money and credit began to go parabolic in the 1990s, as shown in the graph of M3 money increase. The rise in money and credit would mean higher inflation rates. Higher inflation rates would mean higher COLA adjustments, which would lead to bigger deficits. Now, these bigger deficits needed a solution. The solution was to change the way that inflation was being measured. Media reports began to surface on how the consumer price index was overstated. The real inflation rate was actually much lower, according to government and Federal Reserve officials. The Senate Finance Committee appointed the Boskin Commission to study the problem and to find a solution. The Boskin Commission published its final report toward a more accurate measure of the cost of living and then submitted its findings to the Senate on December 4, 1996. This Boskin report recommended downward adjustments in the consumer price index of 1.1%. The CPI, which is used as the basis for COLAs to Social Security and government pensions, if lowered as recommended by the Commission, would reduce future entitlement payments as well as impact other government programs. The CBO estimated that by overstating the CPI, that is the consumer price index, by 1.1%, it added $691 billion to the national debt, or would, by the year 2006, in just 10 years. By then, the annual deficit would rise anywhere from $148 billion to $200 billion a year by overstating the inflation rate. So, in effect, the government was overpaying because the actual inflation rate was actually much lower. So the Boskin Commission recommended several changes to the consumer price index. These changes included, one, develop and publish two indexes, two, abandon the fixed weight formula for CPI goods, three, change the weight of items in the index from arithmetic weighting to geometric weighting, number four, introduce substitutions in the index, number five, seasonal adjustments to account for price increases that occur on a seasonal basis, which would smooth out the fluctuations, and number six, reduce prices by quality improvements. So the result of their implemented suggestions is the mishmash that we have today, which bears absolutely no resemblance at all to reality. Now, this Blue Ribbon Commission's recommendations had widespread support in the Clinton administration, a Republican Congress, and from financial luminaries such as Alan Greenspan, who was expanding the money supply at a very rapid rate, as shown in the graph above. Now let's take a look at substitution in the consumer price index. Up until the Boskin-Greenspan initiative surfaced, the consumer price index was computed every month using a fixed basket of goods. All of that changed after the Boskin Commission report. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, also known as the BLS, began using substitutions in their monthly computations of the CPI, the consumer price index. For instance, if beef prices went up, it was assumed that people would then substitute chicken for beef. If chicken prices went up, then consumers would switch to fish. If all of these prices rose, well, then consumers would become vegetarians or maybe start eating elbow. Let's take a look at weighting. In addition to changing items in the index through the substitution principle, the Bureau of Labor Statistics also changed the weights of items in the index. Instead of straight arithmetic weightings, the Bureau of Labor Statistics began to use geometric weighting. The benefit of geometric weighting is that it automatically gave a lower weighting to those items in the consumer price index that were rising in price and higher weightings to items in the index that were falling in price. So as an example of how geometric weighting can produce lower values, a recent example from the 90s, bull market, will illustrate the point through two value line indexes. The indexes are essentially the same. They're made up of 1,650 stocks. One index is arithmetically weighted and the other is geometrically weighted. Here's the results. Between January of 1990 and December 2000, both indexes, which include the same stocks, produced totally different incomes and returns. You see, the geometric index peaked in April of 1998. The arithmetic index did not reach its peak until May of 2001. So the return from January 1990 to December 2000 was 52% versus the 300% for the arithmetic index. Now the geometric index peaked in 1998, while the arithmetic index did not reach its first peak until 2001.
And since 2001, the arithmetic index has gone on to reach a new high on 6/17/05, while the geometric index has never recovered from its peak in 1998. Now, this is just one example of how geometric weighting can produce lower outcomes, not only in the stock market indexes, but also in inflation rates. Now, there's a factor called hedonics. The manipulation didn't stop there. The Bureau also began to adjust prices for quality. This practice became known as hedonics. Hedonics adjusts the prices of goods as a result of the increased pleasure that a consumer derives from that product. A few examples will illustrate how removed this index has moved away from reality. Tim LaFleur is a commodity specialist for televisions at the Bureau of Labor Statistics. In December last year, he adjusted the price of a 27-inch television set for quality improvements. You see, this 27-inch television set had a retail price of $329.99. However, he decided that the new model, which will still be sold for $329.99, had a better screen. So after putting this improvement through the government's complex hedonic adjustment model, he determined that the improvement in the picture was worth at least $135. Now, if you take this improvement into account, he adjusted the price of the TV by $135, concluding that the price of the TV had actually fallen by 29%. So the price reflected in the CPI, in the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, was not the actual retail store cost of $329.99, but rather $194.99. The only problem for those of us who are consumers is that if we went to Best Buy or Circuit City to buy that TV, we would still pay $329.99. All right, now, another example of hedonics at work is the way the Bureau of Labor Statistics treats rising automobile prices. So Mr. Reese, a specialist for autos, took a 2005 model car, which went from $17,890 in 2004 to $18,490 in 2005. After adjusting for quality items and making anti-lock disc brake standard, the Bureau then adjusted the actual $600 price, the price increase, down by $225. So the problem for those of us that are consumers is that the price of the car in the dealer showrooms was still $18,490. Well, we'll take a look at the substitution effect. We're talking about the core increase or the core rate of the Consumer Price Index, trying to get a handle on inflation and subsistence and survival. Stand by. We'll be back with more right after this. Now, you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. And the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. The Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log, schedule, and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to the authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications so endorsed or recommended will reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not endorsed necessarily by the Law Hour and Editorial Review or vice versa by these publications. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of the network or of this radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to the website georgegordon.org or call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's georgegordon.org or call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. All right, this week we're talking about the economic bubble. In fact, there are a number of bubbles that we hear about in the mainstream media. Housing, stocks, bonds, balance of payments, the federal deficit, General Motors, pension funds, Social Security, Medicare, and inflation, just to name a few. Now, in order to get a handle on inflation, we need to figure, or need to understand, and we need to learn how to figure out, how is inflation calculated? As old Mark Twain said, that there are liars, there are damn liars, and then there are statistics. And what we're dealing with here are statistics and spin. Spin is just another word for lies. Government spin. Government lies. Madison Avenue spin. Madison Avenue lies. Now, the core rate of the CPI has a thing called the substitution effect. Substitution also plays a role in reducing the consumer price index. For instance, from 2001 to 2003, the CPI index fell by 1.6%, reaching a low of 1.1%. Wall Street and the Fed were talking about the risk of deflation. Well, deflation was predicted everywhere in the press. The financial world became fixated over the risk of deflation, even though the monetary presses were working overtime. Credit was and still is mushrooming, and asset bubbles were inflating in the mortgage, bond, and real estate markets. So the reason for the decline was the substitution effect. You see, the substitution effect works like this. Instead of using new car prices, which are going up every year, the Bureau of Labor Statistics substituted used car prices, which were falling. Then, in place of exploding real estate prices, the Bureau gave more weight to the price of rent. Rents, which were falling, as more households bought more and more of these new homes. Now, rents were given more weight even though 69% of households own a home versus the 31% that rent. Now, what makes this look even more ridiculous is that in April, the National Association of Realtors reported a year-over-year price increase in homes nationally of 15%. So here's what that looks like when we graph it out. Year-over-year increase in household residential real estate values in billions of dollars. Looks like this. In the year 2000, it was $1,010,000,000,000. 2001, it was $1,088,000,000,000. 2002, it's $1,197,000,000,000. In 2003, it was $1,430,000,000,000. In 2004, it was $1,601,000,000,000. That's $1,601,000,000,000 in the year 2004. Now, the cumulative additional home value or equity has gone up to $6.3 trillion. Now, we have to wonder as what kind of creativity will be used now that rents are starting to rise as apartment owners remove lease incentives. Perhaps the hedonic models will begin adjusting the rising rents downward due to changes in the quality or the amenities such as the swimming pool, running water, magnificent views of the freeway, or the artistic effects of polluted air in creating colored sunsets. Now, many homeowners may not be aware of it, but that as a homeowner, they receive a fictional income referred to as owner's equivalent rent. Did you know that? It's called your OER, your owner's equivalent rent. And that's because essentially the Bureau of Labor Statistics samples the price of rents in residential housing to come up with what a homeowner would receive in a hypothetical sense if they were to rent their own home. Now, that sounds idiotic to me, since most homeowners would agree that the family castle is in many cases a money pit and it is not a source of income. Unless the home is owned free and clear, most homeowners have cash outgo every month. And that cash outgo is due to mortgage payments, property taxes, utilities, and repairs. And as absurd as this concept may appear, OER, or owner's equivalent rent, gets the largest weighting in the CPI index of 23% versus what the actual average rents are, which gets only a 6% weighting and is purely fictional, and it carries the greatest weight within the CPI index. So the Bureau of Labor Statistics in 1996, based upon a report, a blue ribbon panel, you know, impaneled by President Clinton and reported to Congress, that they would change the methodology by which the consumer price index was calculated. And now it is calculated in such a way that is totally absurd. It's patently false. It doesn't reflect the true inflation rates. Indeed, it shows that inflation is static or that it's going down, when in reality it's anything but static. And it is not going down. We can observe that every week at the supermarket or at the gas station. Now, hedonics helps the Bureau of Labor Statistics keep rising prices for goods in the CPI from ever showing up as rising prices. Even though the cost of housing, energy, food, medical bills, prescription drugs, tuition, and entertainment have soared over the past few years, the government keeps reporting that there's a moderate inflation. Hedonics is partly responsible, and it has become a convenient and subjective way of removing prices and price increases from the consumer price index altogether. The combination of substitution, changing the weight of goods, and rising in price, the hedonics and seasonal adjustments is just one of many ways as to why the CPI and reported inflation has remained so low and as subdued as it is reported each month. You see, the problem is that these numbers are all fictional and they bear absolutely no resemblance at all to what households face each month with their actual budgets. So if you're a Jane housewife and you're trying to balance your weekly food budget or your rent and the mortgage payment, etc., and you're finding that you're not able to pay your bills as easily as you were in the past, it's because of this consumer price index. Now let's take a look at the reality of it. Let's suppose you've got a union job tied to the consumer price index. The actual prices down at Walmart and Best Buy are going up, but the consumer price index doesn't reflect those rising prices because of this skewered system that was created in 1996. So your wages then are not adjusted to the full value of the consumer price index increases. Isn't that just real special? You see, there's the real consumer price index, then there's the fictional consumer price index, and then there is reality. And the consumer price index doesn't come anywhere close to meeting reality. Now let's take a look at Spin City. Let's take a look at seasonal adjustments and non-fuel products. Starting with seasonal adjustments, as if these distortions weren't enough, there are the seasonal adjustments that remove the price increases that occur during certain times of the year. For example, gasoline prices during the summer driving season or heating oil during the winter. Seasonal adjustments are nothing more than intervention. They are designed to remove or to scale down the volatility of price spikes. Now, the only problem is that price spikes never show up in the consumer price index. Only price drops get recorded. Price spikes are statistically smoothed away so that they never show up. Sharp spikes in oil, gasoline, heating oil, or food get statistically adjusted. Now, this keeps the consumer price index low, and that is why the caller at the beginning of this article was so puzzled. What consumers see every day in real life is so different than what the government reports and the market accepts each month. It is unreality TV. Now let's take a look at Spin City. These are the lies that are used by government and the media to cover this up. So another way of understanding the CPI is called the core rate, which is a nonsensical phrase that is commonly used in the financial world. Now, whenever the CPI rises, they back out food and energy to give us the core rate, which is much lower. So whenever the CPI rate goes lower, they refer to the CPI rate and not to the core rate as they did this month. The CPI fell 0.1% in May from April. It was the first decline in 10 months. The drop was due to falling energy prices. Oil prices started out the month of May at $53 a barrel. Then they fell to $49 mid-month before rising back to $52 at the end of the month. Well, now, did this drop of 81 cents in the price of a barrel of oil really account for a drop in the consumer price index of 0.1%? If the CPI is as moderate as the Fed claims, then why are they raising their interest rates? Could it be that inflation asset bubbles such as real estate, mortgages, and consumption, these imbalances in our trade deficit or expanding annual credit of $2.7 trillion, but they haven't really told us anything yet? And then finally, let's clear up the other nonsensical notion of executed energy. Energy is essential to industrial economies, and it takes energy to extract raw materials from the earth. And then it takes even more energy to manufacture the things that we use and consume. And it also takes energy to transport the goods that we produce. Even the energy that we consume takes energy to produce, whether or not, whether it is oil, whether it is natural gas or electricity or something else. Petroleum products contribute about 40% of the energy costs that we use in the United States each year to other products that we never even think about. Put another way, When the price of gasoline goes up, a nickel or a dime a gallon, the price of the UPS service and the postal service goes up because it costs UPS more money to deliver the package. They're not going to take it in the short, so they pass that cost increase on to us. So when the pizza parlor, for instance, has to pay more money for natural gas to cook its pizzas, well, then they have to raise the price of pizza. And that's the way life is. These are called hidden taxes or hidden costs. And they should be reflected in the consumer price index, but they have been adjusted out of the CPI. They have not been adjusted into the consumer price index. Now, transportation accounts for an estimated 2/3 of all of the petroleum use in this country. So all of us burning gas in our cars and all those trucks and locomotives pulling trains take 2/3 of all of the petroleum use that we use in this country. The rest of this petroleum use is accounted for by non-fuel products and petrochemical and feedstocks. So the list below from the EIA and the Department of Energy, that's the Department of Energy, is not exhaustive, but it is illustrative of the many uses of petroleum. So here are some non-fuel products. Non-fuel use of petroleum is small compared with fuel use, but petroleum products account for about 89% of the nation's total energy consumption for non-fuel uses. Let me pause right there and think about this for a moment. Petroleum accounts for about 89% of the nation's total energy consumption when it comes to non-fuel uses, things that we don't use in the gas tank. Well, let's take a look at natural gas. That's a non-fuel use. Let's take a look at the delivery of a package that comes to us. Or let's take a look at the generation of electricity from coal. You think about petroleum. Now, when the price of oil goes from, and get this, in about 2000 or 1999, a barrel of oil was going for $12 a barrel, and today it's up around 60, or about five times more. Not that that necessarily means that oil is a bad value or a bad buy, but it does mean that prices have to go up to compensate for that. And that should be reported in the Consumer Price Index, but as Jim Puplava is pointing out, it is not. It has been indexed out, deliberately taken out of the CPI. So what is the real rate of inflation? 12%, boys and girls, 1% a month, 12% a year. If you want to put this into another form that maybe you can better understand, you know what a $100 bill will buy today. Let's say we go down to the shoe store and there's a pair of shoes for $99.99, and we've got a $100 bill in our pocket. Now we have a choice. Should we buy the pair of shoes today? Then we won't have the $100, but we will have the pair of shoes. Or should we put the $100 in the bank because I don't really need the shoes today? I'll put the $100 in the bank and that'll pay me 4% interest. Let's make it 5% interest. So at the end of the year, the bank is going to give me my $100 bill back plus a $5 bill. I'll get $105 back. Meanwhile, the price of those shoes is going to go from $100 to $112. So it's actually going to cost us 1 year from now $7 more to buy those shoes than it would today. Should I take the $100 bill today and spend that on the shoes and put them on the shelf, or should I put the money in the bank? This is the choice that we all have. Now, the Consumer Price Index should be showing us this 12% increase in prices that is being triggered by oil and housing prices and other inflationary products that we all buy and use, but they're not because they don't put new house prices in the CPI. Although 68% of us live in houses that we call home ownership, and only 32% of us are renting, they use the rent price rather than the housing price because rents are cheaper than housing. So it gives us a false view, a false statistic when we look at the CPI by itself. All right, so there are many non-fuel uses for petroleum, including various specialized products for use in the textile, metallurgical, electrical, and other industries. A partial list of non-fuel uses for petroleum products includes, so for your information, solvents, such as those used in paint, lacquer, and printing inks, lubricating oils and greases for automobile engines and other machinery, petroleum or paraffin wax, which is used in candy making, packaging, candles, matches, and polishes, petrolatum, also known as petroleum jelly, sometimes blended with paraffin wax in medical products and toiletries, asphalt, used to pave highways and roads and airfields, to surface canals and reservoirs, and to make roofing materials and floor coverings. Petroleum coke, used as raw material for many carbon and graphite products, including furnace electrodes and liners, and the anodes used in the production of aluminum. Petroleum feedstocks, used as chemical feedstocks, derived from petroleum principally for the manufacture of chemicals, synthetic rubber, and a variety of plastics. So all of those plastic products that we buy, are made out of petroleum, non-feedstock use of petroleum. And petrochemical feedstocks, these petroleum feedstocks have been used in the commercial production of petrochemicals since the 1920s. Petrochemical feedstocks are converted to basic chemical building blocks and intermediates used to produce plastics, synthetic rubber, synthetic fibers, drugs, and detergents. Naphtha, one of the basic feedstocks, is a liquid obtained from the refining of crude oil. Petrochemical feedstocks also include products recovered from natural gas and refinery gases, such as ethane, propane, and butane. Still other feedstocks include ethylene, propylene, normal and isobutylenes, butadiene, and aromatics, such as benzene, toluene, and xylene. These feedstocks are produced by processing products, such as ethane, separated from natural gas, distillates, naphthas, and heavier oils. Industry data show that the chemical industry uses nearly 1.5 million barrels per day of natural gas liquids and liquefied refinery gases as petrochemical feedstocks and plant fuel. And demand for textiles, explosives, elastomers, and plastics, drugs, and synthetic rubber during World War II increased the petrochemical use of refinery gases. Gas byproducts from the production of gasoline are an important source of many of these feedstocks, and as shown above from the government's own energy information. The use of petroleum is critical to our modern industrial way of life. Does it really make financial sense to remove all of these products from an inflation gauge that is used to assess the cost of living? And think of what life may become without energy. We may soon find out if peak oil is really here. And with the price of energy approaching $60 a barrel, excluding its rise from the cost of living, is as impractical as it is disingenuous. Well, we're about out of time here on this first program talking about the core rate. This is from the Puplava report. It's Financial Sense Online. You can get a copy of this report by simply going to www.financialsense.com/stormwatch. Well, we're about out of time. I'm going to have to leave it right there. We'll be back with more on this thing called the core rate. What we're talking about this week is the economic bubble and what are we going to do to protect ourselves from it. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School direct, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an education service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.